I'm Pierre Daly.
I'm Mike Filmer.
This is Raise Your Average. Most people have an opinion about Bitcoin. Very few of them have done the work to earn it. That's not meant to be an insult. It is just where we are. The conversation about digital assets has been so loud, so polarized, and so full of bad actors on both sides, the true believers and the reflexive dismissers, that most ordinary investors have defaulted to a position without really examining it. Either they are in and they are hoping, or they are out and they are relieved every time there's a crash that seems to validate the decision. What's harder to find is someone who has actually thought this through from first principles, held the position through the noise, and built something durable around the conviction. Rick Edelman has done that. Rick Edelman is the founder of what is today Edelman Financial Engines, one of the largest independent RIA firms in the U.S., and he founded the Digital Assets Council of Financial Professionals in 2018, DACFP for short, at a moment when that was not exactly a career-enhancing move. He has spent over a decade educating advisors and investors on what digital assets actually are, what they mean, how they actually behave, and what a responsible approach to them looks like in a real portfolio. He was early, he was right, and the market has spent the last few years slowly, grudgingly catching up to where he was already standing. We're going to talk today about what that looks like from where he sits right now, because the story has changed. Bitcoin is not the same asset it was 4 years ago. The infrastructure underneath the digital economy is shifting in ways most investors have not registered. And the question is no longer whether this belongs in the conversation. The question is what you do about it.
Yeah. And we talked to him about a year ago. Very different price time frame. You know, the asset was probably almost double where it is today. And it's good to chat with somebody when things are going well. And it's also good to chat with somebody who's an expert in the field when things are being challenged. Because this is where investors can typically have those reactions of selling in the drawdown or a period of low returns, you know, capturing those losses and not necessarily being positioned for the potential gains of the future. And this is across all asset classes, whether you're talking about corrections in stocks like the 2000s or 2008, or talking about bonds in the last 5 years that have been extremely challenged. And so, you know, it's going to be great to dig in with Rick where we are now, how that's changed, how advisors should think about positioning this in portfolios, how they positioned it previously, and what are the talking points today to keep investors involved and educated on what is a new and evolving asset class that is underlying so many potential, you know, serious and wonderful opportunities, real enhancements in banking and the tokenization of assets and settlement layers, and that this has implications for the velocity of money as well. So it'll be interesting. You know, the Clarity Act is being hotly debated as we speak, as it goes through legislative rigor and approval. Right. And it's going to be really interesting to dig in to Rick with that today versus where we were a year ago.
When you see the wild swings that have happened in Bitcoin, I think, you know, the hold on for dear life investors have figured out that if they just hold on, historically, Bitcoin's been through big swings in the past, but so have very important holdings in people's portfolios and folks' portfolios like Alphabet and Meta and Nvidia. I mean, every single one of those Mag 7 stocks has gone through on their own, at their own times, those wild swings as well. And so you really get a lesson, I think, something fantastic or something that behaves as wildly as Bitcoin has in history. And is the very thing investors sit back and think, you know, thank God I didn't buy it when it's down 50%. But they're not buying it when it's down 50%. They're just patting themselves on the back, where I made the right decision not to buy it at 300. Now it's at 150. And you know, that's not productive. That's not a productive investment thought process. And when you're trying to negatively confirm yourself out of a situation. And I think that's something that's happening with cryptocurrency widely, but something that's particularly happening with Bitcoin. And so I think there's a lesson there as well. And I think that a lot of what Rick might have to say today will speak to, you know, a lot of the behavioral risk, a lot of the behavioral concerns that investors have as well. It applies universally.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Bitcoin, if we look at it from the peak, is down about 50%, call it.
Yeah.
And that's taken, you know, some time since October of last year. But as you point out, there are many other assets that are also down 50% that have done so very quickly. If we look at the AI trade, as you allude to, a number of those AI stocks have fallen 50% in less than 2 or 3 months. So it's not unusual for asset classes to do this. You have to think through what's the portfolio allocation, what was prudent. And then rebalancing is kind of a key way to take that decision-making out of your hands.
Yeah. And you got to consider that now Bitcoin and perhaps some of the other crypto assets that are out there are no longer out there. They are assets that have real market cap that should be integrated into portfolios so that you're not unexposed to them at a time, especially now when you know people would have said a year ago, if the price comes down by half, I'm going to back up the truck, and they are not doing that.
Classical behavior.
Yeah.
And I think the use case, I see Rick's joined us, but the use cases and the fundamental side of things have I think expanded and continue to have application that's, you know, relevant and meaningful, even though the price has been challenged.
Way beyond just the currency aspects and into key future infrastructure in the market.
This is Raise Your Average, dedicated to making you a better long-term investor. Join us as we sit down with some of the most interesting names in finance to discuss macro, markets, investment strategies, and more.
Rick, welcome. It is terrific to have you back on the show.
Good morning. Good to be with you. Didn't mean to photobomb you.
How you doing?
Doing well. Doing well. Having a great summer. Hope you are too.
Yes. Thank Absolutely. You. It has been great, but what summer?
It's certainly not been remiss in its headline opportunities.
Absolutely.
That is the truth.
Well, Rick, it's great to have you back on the show. Thank you again so much for joining us, especially at this moment in time. It's great when we have you, when crypto and Bitcoin digital assets are at the top of the headlines, but when they find themselves at the bottom of the headlines in terms of sentiment.
Yeah, but the headlines, it's still in the headlines just for all the wrong reasons.
Exactly. I think the negative sentiment is getting a lot of attention.
I don't think that there's an awful lot of negative sentiment. I think there's a lot of, I'll invent a word, dissentiment. People aren't paying attention to crypto anymore the way that they mm-hmm. were. And there are two fundamental reasons for this, I believe. One is there's a shiny new toy out there called AI.
Yeah.
And that has stolen, if that's the right word, an awful lot of the attention on this latest new tech toy. Blockchain was the newest tech toy, and it ain't so new anymore. It's 16 years old. And along comes AI and the space economy, led by SpaceX, of course. So between SpaceX and Anthropic and OpenAI, they have really stolen the thunder and had the spotlight move off of crypto and onto them. That's one issue. The second issue is, of course, the fact that the price of Bitcoin has been flat for many, many months and sits at about a 50% decline from its high many, many months ago. So between those two facts, people just aren't really paying a whole lot of attention. I don't think anybody's views have changed, meaning if you were negative, you still are.
Right.
And if you were positive, you still are. But there hasn't been anything that has caused anyone to alter their point of view, which is reflected by the fact that the price has been relatively flat. We're trading in an extremely small band for many, many months. And that doesn't seem that it's going to change dramatically in the near term.
Yeah. I wonder if we could, taking that point, step back for a minute and just think through from an advisor's perspective and from your perspective, the journey matters. And, you know, you've been, you know, DAC FP you established 4 or 5 years ago, and you've been through a few of these cycles. You've been deeply involved in this. You've been thinking of it through the lens of a portfolio allocation for advisors and clients. And so, you know, it used to be, if we look back a year ago, there was this, professional threat that if you didn't know about digital assets or Bitcoin, clients were asking more and more. And as you said, the attention economy has shifted away from that. And so I'm wondering, maybe you can walk us through what you saw when you started DAC FP, what you believed then, what gave you conviction then, and what keeps your conviction today.
Sure. I got involved in crypto back in 2012. That's when I first heard about Bitcoin. And like everybody else, you know, I didn't go looking for it. You stumble upon it. It is brought to your attention somehow or other. And like everybody, my reaction was, huh? digital money? What? I didn't get it. Nobody does, I think, at first. At least I certainly wasn't smart enough to. But the people who are talking about it with me were really smart people. And I figured if they get it and I don't, I ought to figure out what they know that I don't. And so rather than dismiss it out of hand, which I've later learned is what most people do, they either dismiss it as either a fad or a fraud, I jumped down the rabbit hole and said, well, what is it? And it didn't take me long to realize that there's a there, that this is fundamentally a transformative technology, as revolutionary for the world of finance as the internet has been. And not only did I reach that conclusion, I also reached a second conclusion, that the financial services industry was oblivious to this fact. This is back in 2013. And because they were oblivious, they weren't engaging. And because they weren't engaging, they weren't offering advice recommendations to clients. We have to remember that the financial services industry and the investment advisory field specifically controls about 2/3 of the nation's wealth. Most investors rely on advisors for recommendations. Very few are do-it-yourself investors. And if the advisory community isn't recommending Bitcoin, then most investors aren't going to buy it because they depend on their advisors for advice. So I needed to spread the word to help advisors realize that this tech exists, what it is, why it's a transformative, and to help them figure out the practice management aspects. How do you talk about it with clients? How do you determine whether or not a client ought to allocate? How much should they allocate? What specifically should they buy? How do you manage it, et cetera? And that's why I created in 2015 DAC FP, the Digital Assets Council of Financial Professionals. And we are a crypto education company. We don't manage assets. We don't sell product. We don't offer product. We aren't offering a buy-side signal. All we do is provide education about the world of crypto, blockchain, digital assets, coins, tokens, the metaverse, you name it. Our goal is to help you understand what this stuff is so you can decide whether or not it's appropriate for clients, and if so, how and how much. So we do conferences, online events, white papers, online content. Our big claim to fame is the CBDA. We launched in 2021 the Certified in Blockchain and Digital Assets Professional Designation listed in the FINRA database. And thousands of financial advisors and home office staff from 37 countries have gone through our program. We're the oldest and largest crypto education organization. And because the industry knows me and they know my reputation, they have confidence that the info I give them is legit, because I'm not trying to sell product. I'm not trying to push a thesis. We're simply providing you the content. And we do consulting for lots of broker-dealers, asset management firms, TradFi organizations, a lot of consulting training from the board level all the way to the advisory audience. And the thesis that I had back then is where it is today. There's really, Mike, not been any significant changes. It's gotten an awful lot easier over the decade and a half. I mean, when I started in 2012, I got booed off the stage. literally, when I told people that they ought to be allocating to Bitcoin. In 2014, 2015, it was still the case. And in 2018, when Bitcoin fell 80%, after rising 1,700%, that just reinforced in everybody's minds that this was a fad or a fraud. Looked an awful lot like Beanie Babies and tulip bulbs. You fast forward to today, and a lot of those original arguments are gone. A lot of the fears and conjecture have disappeared. People used to worry, is Bitcoin going to be banned by the government? Well, the answer today we all know is no. Instead, the government is embracing it. And this isn't a Donald Trump thing. This is a bipartisan congressional thing. Everybody everywhere now recognizes, and I mean everywhere, all over the world, governments as well as corporations, as well as institutional investors, are all fully understanding the transformative power of this technology. And we are seeing adoption at those levels on an unprecedented scale, which is the frustrating part for all this. Because if all that is true, why then is Bitcoin half the value that it was 6 months ago? It doesn't seem to make any sense. And it is frustrating. The only thing I can say is we've seen this before, and not just in Bitcoin. We've seen it in every startup technology. We saw it. You know, one of my favorite stories, favorite recommendations for people to do is to bring up a chart, which you can do in Google really easily. Bring up a chart of the price history of Bitcoin since inception. And we all know what that chart looks like. Astonishing levels of volatility. Mm-hmm. But here's the fun part. Do it for the first 16 years of the life of Amazon. The two charts look identical. You can't tell them apart. And that's because Amazon was an innovative technology when it started. Everybody forgets that Amazon was an online bookseller.
Yeah.
That was Jeff Bezos' big thing. The notion of making a purchase online back in the 1990s when he was suggesting it was astonishing. People's initial reaction was, you want me to type in my credit card number into an online site? Are you nuts? Because that was the scariest thing you could envision. And today, of course, we know where everything is. But for a long time, nobody knew if Amazon would survive. Nobody knew really what it was or how it worked. Nobody knew if there would ever be any consumer adoption for this thing. And the price was all over the place. More than once, I think five times, Amazon stock almost went to zero. Massive increases and decreases in value in its early years as people began to try to figure it out. Today, of course, we all have figured it out, and Amazon is in every stock portfolio on the planet. Bitcoin is enjoying a very similar, or I should say suffering, a very similar trajectory because it's a new technology and people are trying to figure out what is blockchain? What does it mean? Will there be adoption? Will governments permit it? Will they use it? Will they advocate for it? So not at all surprised that there are often a big disconnect between the adoption curve and the price curve. And that's kind of where we're at today.
Yeah. The lessons are the same.
Yeah, for sure. And I also have to add that because we're not over this yet, we haven't completed this journey of adoption and legitimization and so on. There are still a couple of bumps in the road. The biggest one right now is the Clarity Act, which doesn't look at all like it's going to get passed. And it has been on a declining trajectory of approval for many, many months, really a year and a half. And it's looking worse and worse as days go on. And frankly, I blame two people for it. I blame Donald Trump and Brian Armstrong for the failure for the Clarity Act to be passed by now. But be that as it may, it's a roadblock. It is causing some to sit on the sidelines waiting to see what happens with that legislation. It's causing others to persist in their pessimism or their lack of enthusiasm about further engagement. Eventually, they're going to realize, and I think within a month or so, once its outcome is known for sure, people will realize that at the end of the day, it's not going to matter a whole lot. Whether Clarity is passed. Just as you know, we've lived 16 years without it, we'll live another 16 years without it. Doesn't really make any difference. The SEC has been very blunt, saying that if Congress doesn't pass the Clarity Act and write the law, the SEC will simply write the regs that the law would have had. So we're going to get where we need to go. And that's the story of crypto for the last 16 years. Nothing is going to be different there.
where are people today? So as you're speaking to advisors and allocators, is that the thinking today, what you've summarized there? Is there anything else that you would add to that, like the mindset of this moment as we go through this? I mean, we've got, you know, Chairman Armstrong from the SEC saying, we're going to tokenize everything. We've had, conversations with the clearinghouses saying, here's how this is going to roll out because we do some lots of trading and it's going to be tokenized. And here's how we think about it. So from a fundamental level, you know, price is one thing, as you said, with Amazon. But fundamentally, more and more books were being ordered and the product lineup was expanding. And then other business lines crept in. I mean, that's what I see today. I see continued expansion fundamentally of the rollout. That's happening.
Right.
And price is doing this other strange thing. So what else are you seeing from those allocators that you're talking to regularly? Is that, you've summed that up, or is there anything else that you want to add there?
I would say that the traditional allocators have not changed their thesis. There are still a lot of Bitcoin bros who believe, you know, the maximalists who say it's all Bitcoin all the time and nothing else matters. That group of people is diminishing as a percentage of the total audience because it's a finite number. The crypto bros are finite and they aren't growing their ranks. What is growing is the rest of adoption interest. People looking at the commercial application of crypto, meaning Ethereum, Solana, and other coins that are being used in transmittal of money, commercialization, smart contracts, etc. And there's a couple of dozen of those coins that have tremendous revenue. That's one complaint people have about Bitcoin. It doesn't produce revenue. But hey, Solana and Ethereum sure do, along with a whole bunch of other coins.
Well,
we're also looking at the stablecoin market. Mm-hmm. We're looking at the tokenization market. And these are huge. And they're in the very, very, very early stages. But they're growing at astonishing rates, which people are ignoring for now. So what we're seeing is a change in sentiment. People are no longer expressing passion in the conversation of crypto. People used to be very passionate. You know, it's like you're in a bar and everybody's arguing over politics or their favorite sports team. Very passionate conversations. And that is how crypto used to be. It isn't anymore from my perspective. It's now a shrug of the shoulders. People saying, well, of course I'm allocating. Or, of course, I'm not. Yeah. But it's not a passionate conversation. It's sort of the same thing as the annuity conversation. Advisors either allocate to annuities or they don't. But there's not a hell of a lot of passion associated with it. It's just, well, sure, that's a thing. And I either participate or I don't for the reasons I have. And what it all translates to is that increasingly, advisors are acknowledging two things. Number one, from an asset class perspective, Bitcoin represents crypto broadly, 2 or 3% of the total value of assets in America. If you look at the value of stocks and bonds and cash and oil and gold and real estate and crypto, crypto is about 2% of the total, which means if you're a passive investor who simply wants a representative allocation of the markets, you ought to have a 2% allocation to crypto. It's not a hard, you know, it doesn't take a lot of brain power. It doesn't take a lot of passion. You just do it. And for that reason, a lot of advisors are shrugging their shoulders and allocating. You know, I don't know if I like crypto. I'm not sure if I like gold or oil, but I allocate to it because it's real. It's a thing. And to not allocate is an active management decision. And I'm not an active manager. I am a passive indexer owning the broad market. So I'm going to own 60% in equities and 40% in debt because that's the allocation of the market. And within the 60, I'm going to have a little bit of crypto because it's the allocation. So they're just doing it because they recognize it's a thing to do without saying that they love it or hate it. And they rebalance along with the rest of the assets because that's the way they manage assets. So most people are just doing it for that reason. And this is true at the institutional level as well as the retail level. And it's a healthy trend and it's growing. And part of the reason, this is the second half, the part of the reason that this lack of passion and simply acceptance is emerging is because all of the institutional players in the TradFi sector are participating. When you have JP Morgan operating a $2 billion a day blockchain called Kinesix for the last 5 years. When you have Goldman Sachs launching their own ETFs, when you have Morgan Stanley that already did a Bitcoin ETF and now just launched an Ethereum and a Solana ETF, telling its 16,000 advisors to allocate 2-4% for all clients. When Merrill Lynch is saying the same thing, everybody's kind of shrugging and saying, well, how can I not be if all of them are? And so it's just, there's, over the last 15 years, it was easy to be passionate in your views of crypto. Today, there's no reason to be passionate because it's as legitimate as every other asset class. So let's be passionate about the space economy. And let's be passionate about AI, whether or not it'll destroy the world. We don't need to be passionate about crypto anymore.
Yeah. And it's interesting, too, that the level of passion is often a contrary indicator. One of the things I've experienced in my life as an advisor for many, many, many years, for decades, is that when something is boring and something has become sort of less in the spotlight, is often the time, if you haven't allocated, start thinking about that allocation from a market cap perspective and also thinking about it from a crawl, walk, run perspective. You know, you can always start small, see how it feels. Have an allocation that you can defend that's not going to do too much damage to the portfolio that you could rebalance to. Start there. And then when you have it go your way, build a little bit more. Crawl, then walk, then run.
So it's a valid point, Mike, that you're raising. And the challenge that I'm seeing now at the C-suite level is that in the past, if we go back 5 years, probably even just 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, the C-suites were all opposed to crypto because they didn't know if it was legitimate. Compliance couldn't sign off on it. There were no regs to attest to it. So they all said no. They prohibited their advisors from engaging. Today, that has switched. Everybody is saying yes. Compliance has figured out how to say yes. You know, if you do this in this way for this client, we can let you do it. So they've all figured out the method. And they're all now fast introducing their own product. You know, Morgan Stanley isn't buying iBit. They've launched their own. You know, and so they're all getting it. The challenge now, where there's a pipeline struggle, is that while the C-suite has bought in and said yes and created the product and the pathway for their advisors to allocate, where the weak link in the chain now, they haven't yet conducted the training with their advisors to enable the advisors to willingly say, yes, I'll participate. The advisors still can't explain what Bitcoin is. They can't talk confidently with a client. They can't answer client questions because they themselves haven't yet received the training. And that is the bottleneck that we are observing at the biggest wirehouses, where we're doing a lot of conversation with them about this issue, as well as the independent RIAs across the industry, that the rank and file advisor still knows little to nothing about crypto. And therefore, much of what they think they know is false. It's either never been true, they just have a misbelief, misconception that has never been true, or they have a fact that used to be true, but no longer is. I'm amazed at how often people will say something to me that is simply inaccurate, incorrect, that was never true or hasn't been true in a decade. And they don't know what they don't know because nobody has given them the training. They haven't taken the opportunity to get the training that will give them the knowledge that they need to make effective decisions for clients. In other words, we're at the training and education level of this rather than the technological adoption of it. And yeah. I'm not sure how fast we're going to overcome this, but that's the mission I have at DACFP, is to accelerate that as best we can.
As the adoption, like what you've been describing, Rick, is as the adoption of Bitcoin more widely becomes more systematized, more part of a process rather than an opinion, And to your point about the fact that education is lacking on the real, you know, mechanics of all of it, understanding it, being able to answer difficult, sometimes difficult questions for clients who are wondering or being completely full of misconceptions. A lot of advisors are seeing the systematization or the, you know, process-oriented view of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies that are being added to portfolios. For example, again, to your point about 2% of the market's market capitalization is represented by Bitcoin today. So by process, by system, you should be holding 2% in your portfolios. If you claim to be passive, if you claim to be that broad participant in the market, and if you don't own it, then you're expressing an opinion. You're also expressing a view that you're short Bitcoin by not owning it. The institutionalization is paving the way for advisors, yeah, with or without the education, to make that decision to add it to a portfolio without having the grounding.
Agreed. But here's the other wrinkle to it, is that most, because of their lack of education about the asset class, they are equally uneducated about the investment opportunities.
Right.
Meaning, advisors think in terms of Bitcoin. I'm either buying or not buying Bitcoin for the reasons that they have in their heads, many of which are based on faulty information. What they don't understand is that the world of crypto is much more than just Bitcoin.
Absolutely.
And furthermore, they don't understand the plethora of investment opportunity and offering them opportunities for how they engage. Meaning, it's not just the Bitcoin ETFs that were launched in January of 24, 2.5 years ago. It's not just the Bitcoin ETFs. The ETF industry is really, really good at inventing product. And there are now over 200 crypto ETFs in the marketplace from more than a dozen ETF providers, the biggest names in the industry. It's not just a question of a Bitcoin ETF versus an Ethereum ETF versus a Solana ETF. You now have the broad array of ETF product in the world of crypto that you have in the world of equities, meaning we have leveraged ETFs, 2X and 3X. We have inverse ETFs, so you can bet against. We have income ETFs, so you can generate yield. One of the big complaints people have about Bitcoin is that there's no dividend. Yes, there is, through income ETFs, which use options trading the same way you use options trading in equities. We have buffer ETFs that put us a lid on the amount of money you might lose in Bitcoin. How would you like to buy Bitcoin with a guarantee you can't lose more than 10%? Most advisors have no idea that product exists. And it does, from some of the biggest ETF providers in the industry. So the fact that advisors not only haven't taken the time to learn about Bitcoin, they also haven't taken the time to learn about the products that allow them to engage with their client that can address the concerns that they and their clients have, such as volatility, income, tax efficiency.
Yeah.
The crypto industry has solved all these issues. Most don't know those exist. So how can you possibly make an effective decision as an advisor as to whether or not your client ought to buy if you don't know about the product opportunities that exist? And that's part of where the education weakness has perpetuated.
And I think I'll add, Rick, that DACFP and your company does an exceptional job of that. And if you're an RIA or an advisor listening to this, have a look at the site, look at the educational materials. But also, if you're an advisor having difficulty navigating this with your compliance department, I have actually introduced you and your team, Nick, to a couple of RIAs that were having that issue.
Yeah.
And your team has done an exceptional job at helping steward that, because you know, you need it in the IPS. There's a number of steps you need to have. The compliance needs to be on side with the inclusion. And what are the ranges going to be? So a shout out to you and your team for that, because it's exceptional. And if you're in that phase where you're kind of cloudy on this, this is a great way to gain some clarity. The other observation I have, go ahead.
Thank you very much for that. I was going to say that you're exactly right, that many advisors who want to allocate can't because their firms won't let them. And the firms won't let them because the CCO says no. And the reason the CCO says no is they themselves don't know much about this subject. And they're thinking predominantly about their job.
Yes.
I don't want to say yes, have it blow up and get fired. So I'll simply say no. Nobody on Wall Street likes to be first. Everybody's happy to be second.
Yeah.
So I'll wait for everybody else to say yes, then I'll say yes. So if it blows up, I won't get fired because I'll be doing what everybody else is doing. And we are now at that point where so many firms are saying yes, CCOs and GCs are willing to say, oh, it's okay to get in the water, to put my toe in. So you're right, we're getting to that point. So if you're an advisor and your firm is still saying no, reach out to us because we can make contact with your CCO, with your general counsel, with the head of your investment committee to help them understand why it's safe to engage and how to do it so that it is compliant safe.
Yeah. And even
Jamie Dimon,
who would know better?
Jamie Dimon has changed his tune.
Yeah.
Right. So we have that. The other thing I'll add, the other observation I have is it is a generational thing as well. So I find that the generation that is sort of the boomer generation of advisors and investors, those advisors are often a reflection of their client base. They are still very skeptical. The millennial generation, on the other hand, is much more involved and much more invested. And so there's a generational gap there. And don't fall into that trap if you're in that more senior version. You know, this is a new asset class that's going through adoption. Don't be left out.
Can I elaborate on that point, Mike?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'll say yes and. You're correct, but it's not merely that the older advisor, someone who's been doing this for 30 or 40 years, they're in their 50s, 60s, 70s. It's not just that they don't agree with crypto or don't believe in it. For a lot of them, they're simply lazy.
Mm-hmm.
God bless them. I love them to death. I know so many of them. But the bottom line is, look at it from that advisor's perspective. I'm 65 years old. I've been doing this for 30 or 40 years. I have a book of hundreds of millions of dollars, hundreds of clients. Everybody's happy. The portfolios are doing great. My clients are in terrific financial condition. They love me. They're loyal to me. I'm making a lot of money as their advisor. My practice is stable. I'm playing golf one or two days a week. Everything is going great. Why on earth should I bother learning something new and going to the trouble of getting all that education and going to all those classes and listening to those webinars for a lousy 2% allocation? Why bother that heavy lift to just allocate 2%, which, by the way, might blow up, which would anger my client and risk the entire client relationship, and I'd lose 100% of the assets over a 2% allocation. Why should I do that? And that's a combination of laziness and, frankly, rational thinking. Why should the advisor take that gamble? My response to that advisor is, because your clients are allocating anyway. You just don't know it. Just like your teenagers are drinking beer without telling you, mm-hmm. your clients are buying crypto without telling you. Because they know of your disdain, they know of your lack of interest, and that you'll simply try to talk them out of it. So you need to recognize you're losing market share, you're losing share of wallet, you run the risk of your client going elsewhere with the rest of their assets because of their attitude is, if you're not sharing crypto with me, what else are you not sharing? Are you not staying state of the art with the latest and greatest in the field? What else do you not know? What else are you not telling me? You run a credibility risk by not discussing and engaging in crypto. But more importantly, I'm not asking you, Mr. 65-year-old, to engage in this. You probably have a younger member of your team. Let them become the crypto expert on your team. Let them get engaged so that when you do ask a client, do you own crypto? You'll be surprised how often that answer is yes. And you'll be able to say, let me connect you with Susie. She knows a lot about this. And the two of you can have a healthy conversation. You'll expand your customer service. You'll improve your client loyalty. You'll probably generate new referrals and definitely new AUM. So yeah, one of the big impediments is those older advisors are simply saying, why should I bother?
Yeah. I think the other thing is there's a risk there,
exactly.
Right? So as an older advisor, you'll probably have some clients older than you and some clients younger than you. And eventually, you know, clients pass away and pass on assets to the younger generation. And if you don't have any representation of these new assets and those assets are being passed on to the millennial generation, they may look at your approach as a bit antiquated and not quite for them. And so you have the business risk of having those transfer outs come in as you have that, you know, transition that naturally happens in a book of business of older people.
Yeah. You know, I remember years ago, many, many years ago, having a conversation with a 90-year-old client. And his attitude was, I'm 90. I should have all my money in bonds, safe, secure, because all I need is some income. And he was wealthy and he wasn't going to spend all the money that he had. He had, you know, a couple of million bucks. And between his pension and Social Security and his wife's Social Security, they were fine. They were living at, they were the American dream. They had achieved everything they wanted financially. They were able to spoil their children and grandchildren. And his attitude was, why take any risk at all with my money at this stage? It should all be in government bonds. And I said to him, you're telling me that you're not going to spend all the money you have. And he said, yes. And I said, in other words, this money isn't yours anymore. This money actually belongs to your children and grandchildren. You are merely the steward of the money. You're holding on to it to eventually pass it to them. Meaning you shouldn't be creating an asset allocation in your image. You should be creating an asset allocation in their image. If you're going to leave the assets to them, you should leave to them assets they would want to own. And if your grandchildren would have 60% in stocks, you should own 60% in stocks so that they'll inherit that, by the way, with a step up in basis. And along those lines, I can make an equally passionate argument that a 90-year-old should own crypto, even though it would seem to be too risky, too volatile, too, you know, it doesn't generate enough income, blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, if you know you're never going to touch the money and you're just going to pass it down the generations, you ought to be investing the way they need you to invest. And it's not only healthier for the client and their heirs, but as you point out, it's healthier for the advisor when the heirs realize, oh, this advisor was giving my parents the kind of portfolio I like. I can stick with this advisor. I don't have to leave that advisor to go to a new advisor. Because that, as we all know, in the wealth, you know, in a wealth transfer conversation, that's where everybody in Wall Street is scared to death that the books will dissipate when clients die.
That's an eloquent reframing, Rick. I'm not surprised. I mean, who else would know better than the founder of one of the largest RIAs in America?
Well, what I find too often is that people who are setting policy and establishing recommendations have never lived in the trenches. You know, they come from the corporate world. You know, they're smart people. They're highly educated, with massive years of experience, but they've never been in the trenches. They've never engaged in client conversations. They've never served and worked with clients for years or decades. And they miss the behavioral finance. They miss the human dynamic. They miss the interpersonal communication element of it. And therefore they miss what resonates and what motivates people to make decisions. If all you're doing is textbook analysis and spreadsheet computation, your advice is going to be off the mark and you're not going to understand why.
That's a real nugget. That's a really important nugget and a useful piece of information for advisors to consider using when they're dealing with you know, similar issues, but even just in general, like if you're afraid that your clients are going to abandon you on, you know, that the beneficiaries of your clients' assets are going to abandon your practice. This is definitely one way to frame that.
So here's another related issue and challenge with that. When we talk about the fear or the worry, the risk, the concern that I will lose my book in the wealth transfer, guess who doesn't really care all that much? The advisor. Because the advisor's attitude is, I'll be dead too. I'll have long since retired. The preservation of my book, not my problem. You know who cares? The C-suite. PE partners who bought the company. They're the ones who care. Which means that while the firm is desperately concerned with preservation of the book, of the clients, of the AUM, their concern isn't widely or universally shared by the advisors in their practice. there's a disconnect between what the advisor cares about and what the firm cares about. And that disconnect often explains why there's a difference between the firm's policy and the advisor's behaviors. And a great example are the wirehouses that are now telling their advisors, allocate 2 to 4% in crypto, and the advisors are saying, no thanks.
Well, there's an ongoing career risk concern, right? Whether it's well-informed or not. Why exactly to your, you know, the point you made earlier about the 90-year-old client or advisor that you were speaking to who said, you know, why would I do that? Right. Why would I assume all of that extra work only to potentially, but by not being in that space, by not becoming actively involved in these decisions to adopt crypto, to adopt Bitcoin, an allocation of 2%, they're already assuming the career risk, but passively.
Yeah, you're right.
Why not be deliberate?
Yeah, it's attrition. You're absolutely right. And so I try to make it really, really easy for these advisors. And I go right to the core of it. We all know that you need 12 to 24 CE credits every year.
Yeah.
So every time you come to one of my webinars, you get one CE credit. And we offer about 24 a year. You got every one, you'll get 24 credits. Our CBDA course, which is an online self-study, self-paced program. You go through each module whenever you feel like it. You go through that course, you get 18 CE credits, plus a professional designation. You get to brag you hold the CBDA just alongside your CFP and CHFC, et cetera. So you get a professional designation plus 18 CE credits. And oh, by the way, you'll actually learn something. I mean, do you really need to go to another webinar on annuities? I mean, no. When's the last time you actually learned anything in a webinar? You go to a crypto webinar, you'll actually learn something. You'll be entertained as well as informed, and you'll get some CE, which you got to do anyway. So I try to remove all the obstacles that are interfering with your ability or opportunity to get some knowledge. And maybe, just maybe, that new knowledge will have an impact on your point of view.
Absolutely.
Love it.
Rick, Bitcoin gets all of the attention in this conversation, at least, I mean, so far it feels like it's gotten a lot of attention in our conversation, and for good reason. It is the entry point for most investors and most of the flow. But there is another layer to the digital asset story that I think is actually more important to understand over a 10-year horizon, over the next 10-year horizon. And it is the one that gets almost no airtime in mainstream coverage. The infrastructure underneath the financial system is changing, not as a future state concept, as something that is happening now in production, in regulated markets. Tokenization and stablecoins are not investment products you buy. They are changes to the plumbing that will affect products you already hold. Most investors have no mental model for that at all.
Yeah. Agreed. And I don't even know that they need to. Not to diminish the importance of what you're saying, which is the fundamental reason that the three of us are excited about this asset class. But I put it in the context of human behavior. In other words, when someone's buying a car, sales reps are very often quick to brag about the horsepower, when in fact, the typical buyer really wants to know how many cup holders there are. I don't think the average American understands anything about the principles of internal combustion, but they know how to drive a car. And by the same notion, I really don't know that the average, ordinary, everyday American needs to care very much about payment rails or fundamental process methodology for transmittal of money or the underlying basis of fiat and how our financial system operates through SWIFT and DTCC and on and on and on. I don't think they care. I think what they care about is my money safe? Is it liquid? Is it low tax? And if you can do those three things for me, I really don't care about the rest. I want to know it's cyber safe these days. I want to know it's safe from scams and crooks. And I want to know it's available to me and allows me to do what I need it to do. And the rest of it is conversations about horsepower. And I don't care. I want to know about cup holders. And the fact that we are going to undergo, and we are already, to your point, undergoing a significant transformative shift in our financial services system on a global basis, I really don't know that the average investor cares. People will execute an online transaction, uploading their credit card info, and they don't give a lot of thought as to whether that site is safe. They assume that it is, and they're generally correct in that assumption. By the same notion, if we shift from our current analog methodology to a tokenization methodology for the movement of stocks and bonds, I don't think most people are going to know or care how that happened. They're just going to be glad it did, that they can trade 24/7 at lower cost and greater tax efficiency than ever. How it happened, the fact that it was blockchain technology that made it happen, I don't know that they're going to care a whole lot. It's for the advisor to say to the client, I'm giving you an investment allocation that will allow you to benefit from these technological improvements. This is why people are excited about SpaceX. I don't think anybody buying SpaceX stock can say a damn thing about how it works. They just know it does. And they just know that the notion of putting thousands of satellites into orbit has a benefit to us. I get to download a movie in 3 seconds. I don't know how that happened. It has something to do with a satellite. So I think we need to keep that in mind. Too often, we try to get ordinary people to understand the underlying tech, and we end up giving them a level of education and knowledge that goes well beyond their interest level. And that can sometimes do us more harm than good in our effort to persuade them to act.
Yeah, spoon feeding spoons.
Yeah, that's
very simple. And it's funny you talk about that, and like, you know, the car, the toilet. How does your toilet work? Does everyone know how a toilet works? You use it several times a day, but you know it's effective. Another thing I like to ask people, that, you know, this overwhelming confidence in passive investing in the S&P 500 and whatnot. And I said, well, how many companies are actually in the S&P 500? And nobody gets the right answer.
Yeah, was it 503 now?
You got it now. Yeah. It was 497 a little while ago.
Yeah.
So,
or the Wilshire 5000. Nobody gets that right. There's like 3,800 stocks in the Wilshire 5000. So you're absolutely right. It's, you know, it's who's buried in Grant's tomb. Well, if he were a Wall Streeter, it wouldn't be Grant, you know, so.
What is the difference between alternating current and direct current?
Oh, yeah.
It only matters when you go to Europe.
But at the same time, you know, there are tremendous use cases. We've talked about Paul Atkins and the SEC and the adoption there. The other interesting use case I heard, and this comes to the velocity of money and the way in which these technologies are truly superior to the current rails, right? So, you know, a casino operates operations in Macau and Vegas. And because of different business hours, time zones, different weekends, that one casino operator has to hold capital in both of those locations, both Macau and Vegas. Because if they have a winner that day that takes a lot of money from the casino, they need to be able to pay that expeditiously. Once you have crypto rails like Ethereum that can process large transactions at almost no cost in minutes, rather than, oh, I have a big winner on Saturday, banking's closed, I have to keep this money in Macau as well as Vegas, you have an inefficiency of capital. And what's happening in this world is that they actually have centralized where the capital sits in one place, and they can send the capital required simultaneously. You know, casinos operate on the large law of large numbers, lots of games, but still you have these outlier events. When you can centralize capital, you now need less capital in one place, because a simultaneous winner in Macau that costs you might be offset by losers in Vegas. And you can actually transfer that money instantaneously. Now the casino has better capital efficiency. It has better profit margins. It can open more casinos if it chooses to. It can have other businesses lines it wants to go into. Now that's casinos. That's just one example. Think about the guy who's buying rubber for tires that's going on cars, and he's getting rubber from Malaysia and so on. So the efficiency of capital markets improves dramatically when these rails change in this adoption. And that's where it becomes so compelling. Markets are efficient. They are going to pursue the most efficient way to do things. This is one example of how tokenization via rails like Ethereum or Solana become so effective and why they become so adopted. You talked about a number of the funds and the big banks operating their own chains internally and have been doing so for many years. That's precisely why. We're getting into the horsepower a little bit. But, you know, there are compelling reasons that I think sometimes the light will go on for people. They say, oh, okay, yeah. I'm starting to get it.
Yeah, and I agree with 100% with that point. Hey, businesses on a global basis have gotten this. They get it, and they're engaging in it. And because they do recognize the incredible improvement in efficiency and therefore cost savings, even revenue generation as a result of the technology. Absolutely right. I'll take it a step further in the sense that individual retail investors and advisors here in the U.S. make one fundamental error in their analysis or thinking of crypto. They think of it as an American. And this is a fatal mistake, because as an American, it's when someone says, oh, look at Bitcoin, look what it can do, look what crypto can do. Look how it's improved, improvements over banks and the way they operate. As an American, it's easy for me to say, so what? I mean, as much as we all love to hate banks, it's a favorite pastime of Americans to criticize our banks. At the end of the day, let's admit it, banks do a pretty good job at what they do. We have our paychecks direct deposited. We know the money in the bank is safe. It's not going to be lost to a bank failure. It's not going to be stolen by a government in seizing the bank. The money is available on demand. I can write a check instantly. I can go to the ATM and do a withdrawal. I pay most of my bills on auto pay through the bank. The system works. I mean, yeah, the hours are fairly short and their fees are fairly high. Their rules are rather rigid. But at the end of the day, it works. So why bother creating something new that is supposedly better that would force a change in how I'm doing things now, because the way I'm doing it now is good enough for me? That's a very American point of view. It's a legitimate point of view, because in America, we have a stable economy and a legitimate government. But there are a couple of billion people around the world who don't enjoy either one of those. They don't have a stable economy. They're dealing with massive inflation, a devaluation of their local currencies, or they're dealing with corrupt governments who have a tendency to steal assets. For them, holding their money in a bank is idiocy, because the government may seize the money out of the bank may collapse. Even if neither of those happen, the dollar they put in the bank is only worth 70 cents tomorrow. So they need an alternative methodology to truly protect and access their money. And for them, crypto's a godsend.
Absolutely. I mean, we take so much for granted here in our, you know, walled off Western part of the world, right? But I had a thought, you know, during our conversation, and, you know, when did Venmo become a verb? I'm going to Venmo you. I'm going to send you the money right now. And, you know, that's also to your point, Mike, about the casinos being able to interchangeably move money, without friction from one part of the world to the other in order to shore up their wins and losses. But what was the world like before Venmo? Right? I mean, it's really like the analogies are amazing, because I think they help to reframe the question from, you know, should I invest in this, to what does the world look like after this is fully embedded in the system?
once we had things like Venmo in Canada, Interac, you know, being able to send money between parties and companies and whoever you want to pay for something instantly, we can't go back. We're not like, no one's going to say, oh, we're going to take it away. We're going to close Venmo. What? What are you talking about? And and so if the rails that the financial system are built on get changed measurably by adopting blockchain technology in order to facilitate the instantaneous transfer of assets and money across the blockchain, what individual or bank or corporation that needs to manage those aspects on a moment by moment or day-to-day basis is going to say, no, I don't like that. And to you, Rick, I love the American view, which is why if it ain't broke, why fix it? And, but you know what, when something better comes along like Venmo, you can't go back to the old way because it makes things so easy. It makes things so instantaneously, you know, makes it so easy and instantaneously simple for us to transact in any way that we need to.
You're right, Pierre. And this is where the crypto bros got it wrong. The Bitcoin bros of 15 years ago thought that their technology was so much better than the current tech used by the financial services industry that they would destroy, replace the financial services industry. They would eliminate all fiat currency because Bitcoin was so much better than fiat. And the blockchain technology was so superior to the to SWIFT that it would be the end of SWIFT. They were dead wrong. What they failed to recognize is that Wall Street is filled with some of the sharpest minds in the world, with trillions of dollars in assets, immense power, and immense opportunity. And they weren't going to sit by the sidelines and allow themselves to be decimated by this new tech, as the crypto bros anticipated. Instead, they embraced it. And said, you're right. This tech is so cool. It is so much better. It's faster, cheaper, safer than what we're using. We're going to adopt it. So JP Morgan launches Kinesix, its own private blockchain, which has transferred trillions of dollars over the past 5 years across borders. We have the biggest names in the industry racing to tokenize, from the New York Stock Exchange to NASDAQ. They're recognizing, yeah, these guys are right. So instead of letting them defeat us, we're simply going to adopt it. And that's where we're at right now.
It reminds me a little bit of the Amazon conversation we talked about earlier. Yeah.
Right.
2000. Why would I order? I'm going to order something and not see it. I got to go to the store. I got to touch it. I got to hold it. Go into any condo or apartment building in New York City and go into their mailroom, and every day you see a full room of Amazon packages.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why would I ever do that? Well, you know, adoption does occur slowly and then all at once. And then you
could
know, you think
could
about-
Could you go back to the old way?
Yeah, could you go back? You're going to go to the bookstore to buy the book? Or what bookstore? Try and find one. And then you think about, you know, the stablecoin world, and you've got, you know, stablecoins holding more treasury bills than countries like, you know, Germany or South Korea or the United Arab Emirates. Like this adoption is occurring at a rate that's under the surface quite fast, quite large. And as you alluded to earlier, everyone's given it a shrug.
Yeah.
Except to your counterpoint, Rick, about, you know, folks in emerging markets or in developing countries around the world who don't have the stable banking or government system, political system in place, don't have the security that we have, that we take for granted. That's most of the rest of the world, other than, you know, Europe and the Americas and parts of Asia. Like there are, you know, there's very few people in the world who have it as good as we do. And that's why we take it for granted.
Yeah. We have to remember that this is why crypto is a global asset and why the US can't kill it. As much as Joe Biden and Gary Gensler tried to kill it, they can't, because it's a global asset, not an American asset.
And trying to kill it had unintended consequences, very counterproductive, unintended consequences. It emboldened the Bitcoin crowd, the crypto crowd, right?
And now true. The result was they raised $400 million in PACs and defeated dozens and dozens of Congress candidates who opposed crypto. In the 2024 election, there were, I think, 57 members of Congress either running for re-election or election who were defeated because of their opposition to crypto. And none of that would have happened had they not had, you know, the anti-community not taken such a strong stand by Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden and Gary Gensler. So, yeah, that was an outcome that I think they didn't anticipate.
And now there's kind of a counter-complacency.
Yeah. And I think the crypto community is recognizing its mistake there. I alluded to it earlier regarding the Clarity Act. They thought Clarity was a done deal. And so they were complacent. They sat back and, you know, toasted the victory before the war was won. And here we are, no Clarity Act. And I think Brian has acknowledged publicly that he was wrong in his opposition months ago. But it's frankly, I think, a little too little too late.
But the political friction leads to other unintended consequences, workarounds. It's going to happen. Yeah.
But it slows things down.
It does slow it down. But when the technology is clearly better, it will be adopted over time. And this the current wranglings in the Clarity Act are an interesting microcosm of that. As we were seeing that go through. Its various iterations
and frankly,
everybody on the record before the midterms come and say, okay, well, we're going to vote on something and you're going to tell the U.S. people where you stand on this
here's the challenge, Mike, is that the Clarity Act has now morphed into two parts. One is the crypto tech rules regs itself. The other is the ethics clause, which did not exist as part of the act 6 months ago or 18 months ago. But it's a key element today and the key reason why many in Congress are opposing the bill. And this is at the feet of Donald Trump. His blatant self-dealing, his and his family's engagement in crypto, whereby his own acknowledgement has generated nearly $2 billion of profits at, many argue, the expense of retail investors, has really put a strong amount of distaste in many people's minds, and legitimately so, in my view. And the effort to fix that by introducing an ethics clause into the bill to prevent not just the president, but any president and any member of Congress from engaging in such self-dealing is an important element. I think we're all pretty fed up with the self-dealing of Congress, the insider trading from Nancy Pelosi on the Democratic side to Donald Trump's behaviors on the Republican side. And we can all look at Joe Biden's activities and that of his son Hunter. And the list goes on and on in both parties. Nobody's safe from accusations of inappropriate, unethical behavior. And the act now contains a clause to address it, prevent it, and put a stop to it. Many are concerned that those new parts of the bill don't go far enough. There are too many loopholes, too many limitations, and that is why they're arguing they're not going to support the bill. We're going to have to see how it shakes out.
Yeah.
But we need to recognize that we expect more from our representatives. We want them to behave ethically and morally with transparency, focusing on the best interests of their constituents. And as we all know, far too often, Congress and the administration let us down.
That's going to be very interesting to see where this all, where and when, maybe is the bigger question, this all lands. Rick, what you've built with DACFP, with the Digital Assets Council for Financial Professionals, is genuinely rare. It's a serious education infrastructure for an asset class that the establishment spent years trying to ignore. For the person listening to this who's starting from zero and wants to actually do the work rather than just take a position, where do you send them first?
Just go to our website, dacfp.com, dacfp.com. You'll find all kinds of content there. All of it's free. Our white papers, our videos, the webinars we've hosted, they're all there, all the recordings. And the best place to start, really, I'll mention two. One is enroll in the CBDA course. It's a world-class faculty. I mean, it features Scott Stornetta, who's the co-inventor of blockchain technology. Folks like Anders Bronworth, who was with the Boston Fed. It's a self-study online course. Everybody raves about it. You'll love it. It's simple, easy, and it's perfect for people who know little to nothing about crypto. The second, just read my book, The Truth About Crypto, the number one Amazon bestseller, which will give you the info you need as an investor and as an advisor. A lot of the book, a lot of the course is all focused not just on crypto, but on practice management, investment thesis, portfolio construction, crypto taxation, regulation, compliance, and so on. And it's those two, the CBDA and my book, The Truth About Crypto, great places to start.
And do the advisors who enroll or people enrolled, they continue to have access to all that content even after they've done the course, I'm assuming?
Very much so. We update the program every year. We add modules annually, and everybody who goes through the course is they renew every year, and they go and get those update courses. So you're always staying current with the latest and greatest that's going on in crypto. With just a 1 hour annual CE online webinar that you watch whenever you feel like it. So it's simple and easy to do, and keeps you current with what's happening in the field. If you want to spend 2 days, come to our annual crypto conference that's in June in Dallas every year. But the online stuff is simple, easy, effective. You get CE credits. Everything that we have in the course is always current.
Amazing. Any final thoughts that you want to leave with those investors and allocators out there who are working through the current allocation to digital assets?
One of the reasons I've been involved in this since the beginning, and one of the reasons I argue people should pay attention, set aside the investment potential, set aside the passion, whether you love it or hate it. Of all the asset classes that exist, and I'll put AI in the same category, I find crypto, blockchain technology, digital assets to be the most intellectually interesting of all asset classes. It's a fascinating topic, just like AI has now proven itself to be. And so if you enjoy intellectual conversation, intellectual debate, intellectual philosophical considerations, you'll just thoroughly enjoy learning about this. It's fascinating. Regardless of whether you love it or hate it, will ever invest in it or not, none of that matters. Just as an intellectual pursuit, it doesn't require an MBA from MIT. Anybody can enjoy this intellectual conversation. It's fascinating and fun.
Yeah. Embrace your intellectual curiosity.
Yeah.
That's a great take. Rick, thank you for always making time for us and with us on Raise Your Average. We love having you.
It's my pleasure. Appreciate the work you folks are doing. And if we can be helpful, just let us know.
Likewise, we appreciate what you're doing as well.